but I had done something, all that I could do indeed, and I felt just fractionally better because of it. After that I began searching in cupboards and sideboards and kitchen dressers until at last, at the very back of one such in the dining room, I found a bottle of brandy, 30 years old and still fully corked and sealed. I opened it, found a glass, and poured myself as large a measure as seemed sensible to be consumed by a man in a state of great shock, some hours away from his last meal. The room had clearly not been used by Mrs. Drabblow for many years. The furniture had a faded bloom from the salt in the air, and the candlesticks and epinier were tarnished, the linen cloths stiffly folded and interleaved with yellowing tissue, the glass and china dusty. I went back into the one room in the house that had some pretensions to comfort, for all it was chilly and musty-smelling, the little sitting-room. And there I sipped my brandy, and tried as calmly as I could to work out what I should do. But as the drink took effect, I became more rather than less agitated, and my brain was in an increasing turmoil. I began to be angry with Mr. Bentley for sending me here, at my own foolish independence and block-headedness in ignoring all the hints and veiled warnings I'd received about the place, and to long, no, to pray for some kind of speedy deliverance, and to be back in the safety and comforting busyness and clamour of London, among friends, indeed among any people at all, and with Stella. I could not sit still in that claustrophobic and yet oddly hollow-feeling old house, but rambled about from room to room, lifting up this and that object and setting it down again hopelessly, and then going upstairs to wander into shuttered bedrooms, and up again to attics full of lumber, uncarpeted and without curtains or blinds at the tall narrow windows. Every door was open, every room orderly, dusty, bitterly cold and damp, and yet also stifling. Only one door was locked, at the far end of a passage that led away from 3 bedrooms on the second floor. There was no keyhole, no bolt on the outside. For some obscure reason, I became angry with that door. I kicked at it and rattled the handle hard, before giving up abruptly and returning downstairs, listening to the echo of my own footsteps as I went. Every few moments I went to one or other of the windows, rubbed my hand across the pane to try and see out, but although I rubbed at a thin film of grime, enough to leave a clear space, I could not rub away the curtain of sea mist that was so close up to the glass on the outside. As I stared into it, I saw that it was still constantly shifting, like clouds, though without ever parting or dispersing. At last I slumped down on the plush-covered sofa in the great high-ceilinged drawing-room, turned my face away from the window, and gave myself up, along with the last of a second glass of the mellow, fragrant brandy, to melancholy brooding and a sort of inward-looking self-pity. I was no longer cold, no longer afraid or restless. I felt cocooned against the horrible events that had taken place out on the marshes, and I allowed myself to give way, to slip down into this mindless state, which was as inchoate as the fog outside, and there to rest, wallow, and find, if not peace, at least a certain relief in the suspension of all extremes of emotion. A bell was ringing, ringing through my ears, inside my head. Its clangor sounded at once very close and oddly distant. It seemed to sway, and I to sway with it. I was trying to struggle out of some darkness which was not fixed, but shifting about, as the ground seemed to be shifting beneath my feet, so that I was terrified of slipping and falling down, down, of being sucked into a horrible echoing maelstrom. The bell went on ringing. I came awake in bewilderment, to see the moon, huge as a pumpkin, beyond the tall windows in a clear black sky. My head was thick, my mouth furred and dry, my limbs stiff. I had slept perhaps for minutes, perhaps for some hours. I'd lost my sense of time. I struggled upright, and then I realized that the bell I heard was not part of the confusion of my fitful nightmare, but a real bell sounding through the house. Someone was at the front door. As I half walked, half fell because of numbness in my feet and legs, where I'd lain cramped upon the sofa, out of the room and into the hall, I began to remember what had happened, and above all I felt an upsurge of horror as the memory returned to me. the business of the pony and trap from which I'd heard the child screaming out on Eel Marsh. All the lights I'd left on were still shining out and must have been seen, I thought, as I pulled open the front door, hoping against hope to see a party of searchers and helpers, strong men, people to whom I could give it all over, who would know what to do and who would, above all, take me away from this place. But in the light of the hall, as it shone out, and under the full moonlight too, there stood on the gravel drive only one man, Kekwick, and behind him the pony and trap. All seemed quite real, quite normal, and completely unharmed. The air was clear and cold, the sky thick with stars. The marshes lay still and silent and gleaming silver under the moon. There was no vestige of mist or cloud, not so much as a touch of dampness in the atmosphere. All was so changed, so utterly changed, that I might have been reborn into another world, and all the rest had been some fevered dream.
"You have to wait for a fret like that to clear itself. There's no crossing over while a fret's up,"
Kekwick said matter-of-factly.
"Unlucky for you, that was."
My tongue seemed to be held fast against the roof of my mouth, my knees about to buckle beneath me.
"After that, there's the wait for the tide."
He looked all around him.
"Awkward place, you'll be finding that out fast enough."
It was then that I managed to look at my watch and saw that it was almost 2 o'clock in the morning. The tide had just begun to recede again, revealing the Nine Lives Causeway. I had slept for almost 7 hours, almost as long as I would on any normal night, but here I was with hours still to go before dawn, feeling as sick and wretched and weary as any man who's lain sleepless for hour after hour. "I wouldn't have expected you to come back at this hour," I managed to stammer. "It's very good of you." Kekwick pushed his cap back a little in order to scratch at his forehead, and I noticed that his nose and much of the lower part of his face were covered in bumps and lumps and warts, and that the skin was porridgey in texture and a dark, livid red.
"I wouldn't have left you over the night,"
he said at last.
"Wouldn't have done that to you."
I felt a moment of light-headedness, for we seemed to have slipped into the way of normal, practical conversation. Indeed, I was glad to see him. Never had I welcomed the sight of a fellow human being more in my life, and to see his solid little pony that stood quietly, patiently by. But then the second recollection returned to me, and I blurted out, "But what happened to you? How do you manage to be here? How did you get out?" Then my heart lurched, as I realized that, of course, it had not been Kekwick and his pony who'd gone into the quicksand. Not at all, but someone else. Someone with a child. And now they were gone, dead. The marsh had taken them, and the waters had closed over them. And no ripple or disturbance of the faintest kind showed on that still gleaming surface. But who, on a dark November evening in the rolling mist and the rising tide, who had been driving out, and with a child, too, in that treacherous place, and why? Where had they been driving to, and where coming from? Well, this was the only house for many miles, unless I'd been right about the woman in black and her hidden dwelling. Kekwick was looking straight into my face, and I realized that I must appear dishevelled and wild, not at all the business-like, confident, smart young lawyer he'd left at the house that afternoon. Then he indicated the pony trap.
"Best get in,"
he said. "Yes, but surely..." He had turned away abruptly and was climbing into the driving seat. There, looking straight ahead of him, huddled into his greatcoat and the collar turned to cover his neck and chin, he waited. That he was fully aware of my state, knew something had happened to me, and was quite unsurprised was clear, and his manner also told me unmistakably that he did not wish to hear what it was, to ask or answer questions, to discuss the business at all. He would fetch and carry, and that reliably, and at any hour, and he would do no more. Silently, quickly, I went back into the house and switched off the lights, and then I got into the car and let Kekwick and his pony take me away, across the quiet, eerily beautiful marshes under the riding moon. I fell into a sort of trance, half sleeping, half waking, rocked by the motion of the cart. My head had begun to ache miserably, and my stomach to contract with spasms of nausea now and again. I did not look about me, though Sometimes I glanced up into the great bowl of the night sky and at the constellations scattered there, and the sight was comforting and calming to me. Things in the heavens seemed still to be all right and unchanged. But nothing else was, within me, or all around. I knew now that I had entered some hitherto unimagined, indeed unbelieved-in, realm of consciousness, that coming to this place had already changed me, and that there was no going back. For today, I had seen things I had never dreamed of seeing, and heard things too. That the woman by the graves had been ghostly, I now, not believed, no, knew for certainty, lay deep within me. I realized that it had become fixed and immovable, perhaps during that restless, anguished sleep. But I began to suspect that the pony and trap that I'd heard out on the marsh, the pony and trap with the child who'd cried out so terribly, and which had been sucked into the quicksands, while marsh and estuary, land and sea had been shrouded in that sudden fog, and I lost in the midst of it, they too had not been real, and not there, present, not substantial, but ghostly also. What I had heard as clearly as I now heard the roll of the cart and the drumming of the pony's hooves. And what I had seen, the woman with the pale, wasted face, by the grave of Mrs. Drablow and again in the old burial ground, I had seen. I would have sworn to that on oath, on any testament. Yet they'd been, in some sense I did not understand, unreal, ghostly, things that were dead. Having accepted so much, I at once felt calmer. And so we left the marsh and the estuary behind us, and clopped along the lane in the middle of that quiet night. I supposed that the landlord of the Gifford Arms could be knocked up and persuaded to let me in, and then I intended to go up to that comfortable bed and sleep again, to try and shut out all these things from my head and my heart, and not think of them more. Tomorrow, in daylight, I would recover myself and then plan what I was going to do. At this moment I knew that, more than anything else, I did not want to have to go back to Ealmarsh House, and must try to find some way of extricating myself from any more dealings with the affairs of Mrs. Drablow. Whether I would make some excuse to Mr. Bentley, or endeavour to tell him the truth and hope not to be ridiculed, I did not try and decide. It was only as I was getting myself ready for bed, the landlord having proved most sympathetic and accommodating, that I began to think again about the extraordinary generosity of Keckwick, in coming out for me the moment the mist and tides enabled him to do so. He would surely have been expected to shrug his shoulders, retire, and plan to collect me first thing in the morning. But he must have waited up, and perhaps even kept his pony harnessed, in his concern that I should not have to spend a night alone in that house. I was profoundly grateful to him, and I made a note that he should receive a generous reward for his pains. It was after 3 o'clock when I climbed into bed, and it would not be light for another 5 hours. The landlord had said I was to sleep on as long as I chose, no one would disturb me, and a breakfast would be provided at any time. He, too, in his different way, had seemed as anxious for my welfare as Keckwick, though about them both there was the same extreme reserve, a barrier put up against all inquiry, which I had the sense not to try and break down. Who could tell what they themselves had seen or heard? How much more they knew about the past and all manner of events, not to mention rumours and hearsay and superstition about those events, I could not guess. The little I'd experienced was more than enough, and I was reluctant to begin delving into any explanations. So I thought that night, as I laid my head on the soft pillow, and fell eventually into a restless, shadowy sleep, across which figures came and went, troubling me, so that once or twice I half woke myself as I cried out or spoke a few incoherent words. I sweated. I turned and turned about, trying to free myself from the nightmares, to escape from my own semi-conscious sense of dread and foreboding. And all the time, piercing through the surface of my dreams, came the terrified whinnying of the pony and the crying and calling of that child over and over, while I stood helpless in the mist, my feet held fast, my body pulled back. And while behind me, though I could not see, only sense her dark presence, hovered the woman. Chapter 7. Mr. Jerome is afraid. When I awoke, it was again to see the pleasant bedroom filled with bright winter sunshine. But it was with a great sense of weariness and bitterness, too, that I contrasted my present state with that of the previous morning, when I'd slept so well and woken so refreshed, and sprung out of bed, eager to begin the day. And was it only yesterday? I felt as if I'd journeyed so far, in spirit if not in time, experienced so much, and been so churned about within my formerly placid and settled self, that it might have been years since then. Now I felt heavy and sick in my head, stale and tired and jangled too. My nerves and my imagination were all on edge. But after a while I forced myself to rise, as I could hardly feel worse than I did lying in the bed that now felt as lumpish and uncomfortable as a heap of potato sacks. Once I'd drawn back the curtains on a sharp blue sky, and taken a good hot bath, followed by a rinse of my head and neck under the cold tap, I began to feel less frowsty and depressed, more composed, and able to think in an orderly way about the day ahead. Over breakfast, for which I had a better appetite than I'd expected, I put to myself the various alternatives. Last night I'd been adamant, and would have brooked no possible opposition. I was having nothing more to do with Eel Marsh and the Drablow business, but would telegraph to Mr. Bentley, leave matters in the hands of Mr. Jerome, and take the first available train to London. In short, I was going to run away. Yes, and that was how I saw it in the bright light of day. I attach no particular blame to my decision. I had been as badly frightened as a man could be. I did not think that I would be the first to run from physical risks and dangers, although I had no reason to suppose myself markedly braver than the next person. But these other matters were altogether more terrifying, because they were intangible and inexplicable, incapable of proof and yet so deeply affecting. I began to realize that what had frightened me most, and, as I investigated my own thoughts and feelings that morning, what continued to frighten me, was not what I'd seen. There'd been nothing intrinsically repellent or horrifying about the woman with the wasted face. It was true that the ghastly sounds I had heard through the fog had greatly upset me. But far worse was what emanated from and surrounded these things and arose to unsteady me. An atmosphere, a force, I do not exactly know what to call it, of evil and uncleanness, of terror and suffering, of malevolence and bitter anger. I felt quite at a loss to cope with any of these things.
"You'll find Crith in a quieter place today,"
the landlord said as he came to clear away my plate and replenish my pot of coffee.
"Market day brings everyone from miles about. There'll be little enough happening this morning."
He stood for a moment looking at me closely, and I again felt it necessary to apologize for having had him get up and come down to let me in the previous night. He shook his head.
"Oh, I'd rather that than have you spend an uncomfortable night anywhere else."
As it happened, my night was a bit disturbed in any case. I seemed to have an overdose of bad dreams and be generally restless. He said nothing. "I think what I need this morning is some exercise in the fresh air. Perhaps I'll walk into the countryside a mile or so, look at the farms belonging to some of the men who were all here doing their market business yesterday." What I meant was that I planned to turn my back upon the marshes and walk steadfastly in the opposite direction.
"Well, you'll find it nice and easy walking. We're flat as a bedsheet for many miles about. Of course, you could go a good deal further if you want to be on horseback."
"Alas, I've never ridden in my life, and I confess I don't feel in the mood to start today."
"Or else," he said suddenly with a smile, "I can lend you a good stout bicycle."
A bicycle? He saw my expression change. As a boy, I had bicycled regularly and far, and indeed Stella and I still sometimes took the train out towards one of the locks and cycled for miles along the Thames towpath with a picnic in our baskets.
"You'll find it around the back in the yard there. Just help yourself, sir, if the fancy takes you."
And he left the dining room. The idea of bicycling for an hour or so, to blow away the clinging cobwebs and staleness of the night, to to refresh and restore me was extremely cheering, and I knew that my mood was uprising. Moreover, I was not going to run away. Instead, I decided to go and talk to Mr. Jerome. I had formed some notion of asking for help in sorting out Mrs. Drabble's papers. Oh, perhaps he had an office boy he could spare, for I was now sure that in daylight, and with company, I was strong enough again to face Eel Marsh House. I would return to the town well before dark, and work as methodically and efficiently as possible, nor would I take any walk in the direction of the burial ground. It was remarkable how physical well-being had improved my spirits, and as I stepped outside into the market square, I felt once again my normal, equable, cheerful self, while every so often a spurt of glee arose inside me at the anticipation of my bicycle ride. I found the office of Horatio Jerome, land and estate agent, two pokey low-ceilinged rooms over a corn merchant's store, in the narrow lane leading off the square, and expected also to find an assistant or clerk to whom to give my name. But there was no one. The place was silent, the outer waiting room dingy and empty. So, after hovering about for a few moments, I went to the only other closed door and knocked. There was a further pause, and then the scraping of a chair and some quick footsteps. Mr. Jerome opened the door. It was clear at once that he was by no means pleased to see me. His face took on the closed-up, deadened look of the previous day, and he hesitated before eventually inviting me into his office, and cast odd half-glances at me, before looking quickly away again to a point over my shoulder. I paused, waiting, I suppose, for him to inquire how I'd fared at Eel Marsh House. But he said nothing at all, and so I began to put my proposal to him. You see, I had had no idea, I don't know whether you had, of the volume of papers belonging to Mrs. Drabble, tons of the stuff, and most of it I've no doubt so much waste. But it will have to be gone through item by item nevertheless. It seems clear that unless I am to take up residence in Crithin Gifford for the foreseeable future, I shall have to have some help. Mr. Jerome's expression was one of panic. He shifted his chair back, further away from me, as he sat behind his rickety desk, so that I thought that if he could have gone through the wall into the street, he would have liked to have done so.
I'm afraid I can't offer you help, Mr. Kipps. Oh, no.
I wasn't thinking that you would do anything personally, I said in a soothing tone, but perhaps you have a young assistant?
There's no one. I'm quite on my own. I cannot give you any help at all.
Well, then help me to find someone. Surely the town will yield me a young man with a modicum of intelligence, and keen to earn a few pounds, whom I may take on for the job? I noticed that his hands, which rested on the sides of his chair, were working, rubbing, fidgeting, gripping and ungripping in agitation.
I'm sorry. This is a small place, and young people leave. There are no openings.
But I'm offering an opening, albeit temporary.
You will find no one suitable.
He was almost shouting at me. Then I said very calmly and quietly, Mr. Jerome, what you mean is not that there is no one available, that no young person, or older person, for that matter, could be found in the town or the neighbourhood able and free to do the work if a thorough search were to be made. There would not, I am sure, be many applicants, but certainly we should be able to find one or two possible candidates for the job. But you are backing away from speaking out the truth of the matter, which is that I should not find a soul willing to spend any time out at Eel Marsh House for fear of the stories about that place proving true, for fear of encountering what I have already encountered. There was absolute silence. Mr. Jerome's hands continued to scrabble about like the paws of some struggling creature. His pale domed forehead was beaded with perspiration. Eventually he got up, almost knocking over his chair as he did so, and went over to the narrow window to look out through the dirty pane onto the houses opposite and down into the quiet lane below. Then, with his back to me, he said at last,
"Keckwick came back for you."
Yes, I was more grateful than I can say.
"There's nothing Keckwick doesn't know about Eel Marsh House."
"Do I take it he fetched and carried sometimes for Mrs. Drabble?" He nodded.
"She saw no one else. Not—"
His voice trailed away. "Not another living soul," I put in evenly. When he spoke again, he sounded husky and tired.
"There are stories," he said,
tales. There's all that nonsense.
I can believe it. Such a place would breed marsh monsters and creatures of the deep and jack-o'-lanterns by the cartload.
You can discount most of it.
Of course, but not all.
You saw that woman in the churchyard.
I saw her again. I went for a walk all around the ground Ealmarsh House stands on, after Kepwick had left me yesterday afternoon. She was in that old burial ground. What are the ruins, some church or chapel?
There was once a monastery on that island, long before the house was ever built. Some small community that cut itself off from the rest of the world. There are records of it in the county histories. It was abandoned, left to decay, oh, centuries ago.
And the burial ground?
There was some later use, a few graves.
The Drablows? He suddenly turned to face me. There was a sickly, greyish pallor over his skin now, and I realized how seriously he was affected by our conversation, and that he would probably prefer not to continue. I had to make my arrangements, but I decided at that moment to abandon the attempt to work with Mr. Jerome and to telephone instead directly to Mr. Bentley in London. For that purpose, I would return to the hotel.
"Well," I said, "I'm not going to be put out by a ghost or several ghosts, Mr. Jerome. It was unpleasant, and I confess that I shall be glad when I've found a companion to share my work out at the house. But it will have to be done. And I doubt if the woman in black can have any animosity towards me. I wonder who she was. Is!"
I laughed, though it came out sounding quite false into the room.
"I hardly know how to refer to her."
I was trying to make light of something we both knew was gravely serious, trying to dismiss as insignificant and perhaps even non-existent something that had affected us both as deeply as any other experience we'd undergone in our lives, for it took us to the very edge of the horizon where life and death meet together. "I must face it out, Mr. Jerome. Such things one must face." And even as I spoke, I felt a new determination arise within me.
"So I said."
Mr. Jerome was looking at me pityingly.
"So I said. Once."
But his fear was only serving to strengthen my resolve. He had been weakened and broken by what? A woman? A few noises? Or was there more that I should discover for myself? I knew that if I asked him, he'd refuse to answer, and in any case I was uncertain whether I wanted to be filled up with all these frightening and weird tales of the nervous Mr. Jerome's past experiences at Ealmarsh House. I decided that, if I were to get to the truth of the business, I should have to rely upon the evidence of my own senses and nothing more. Perhaps, after all, I should do better not to have an assistant. I took leave of Mr. Jerome, remarking as I went that in all probability I should see nothing more of the woman or of any other peculiar visitors to the late Mrs. Drablow's house.
"I pray that you do not,"
Mr. Jerome said, and he held on to my hand with a sudden, fierce grip as he shook it.
"I pray that you do not." "Don't worry about it,"
I called, deliberately making myself sound carefree and cheerful, and I ran lightly down the staircase, leaving Mr. Jerome to his agitation. I returned to the Gifford Arms, and instead of telephoning, wrote a letter to Mr. Bentley. In it I described the house and its hoard of papers, and explained that I should have to stay longer than anticipated, and that I expected to hear if Mr. Bentley required me to return at once to London and make some other arrangements. I also made a light remark about the bad reputation Ealmarsh House enjoyed locally, and said that for this reason, but also for others rather more mundane, it might be difficult for me to get any help, though I was anxious to try. The whole business, nevertheless, should be completed within the week, and I would arrange for the dispatch of as many papers as seemed to be important to London. Then, putting the letter on the table in the lobby, to be collected at noon, I went out and found the landlord's bicycle, a good, old-fashioned sit-up-and-beg, with a large basket on the front, almost like that sported by the butcher boys in London. I mounted it and pedalled out of the square and away, up one of the side streets, towards the open country. It was the perfect day for bicycling, cold enough to make the wind burn against my cheeks as I went, bright and clear enough for me to be able to see a long way in all directions across that flat, open landscape. I intended to cycle to the next village, where I hoped to find another country inn and enjoy some bread and cheese and beer for lunch. But as I reached the last of the houses, I could not resist the urge that was so extraordinarily strong within me to stop and look, not westwards, where I might see farms and fields and the distant roofs of a village, but east. And there they lay, those glittering, beckoning silver marshes, with the sky pale at the horizon where it reached down to the water of the estuary. A thin breeze blew off them with salt on its breath. Even from as far away as this I could hear the mysterious silence, and once again the haunting, strange beauty of it all aroused a response deep within me. I could not run away from that place. I would have to go back to it, not now, but soon. I'd fallen under some sort of spell of the kind that certain places exude, and it drew me, my imaginings, my longings, my curiosity, my whole spirit, towards itself. For a long time I looked and looked, and recognized what was happening to me. My emotions had now become so volatile and so extreme, my nervous responses so near the surface, so rapid and keen, that I was living in another dimension. My heart seemed to beat faster, my step to be quicker. Everything I saw was brighter, its outlines more sharply, precisely defined. And all this since yesterday. I had wondered whether I looked different in some essential way so that, when I eventually returned home, my friends and family would notice the change. I felt older and like a man who was being put to trial, half fearful, half wondering, excited, completely in thrall. But now, managing to suspend this acute emotional state, and in order to help myself retain my normal equilibrium, I would take some exercise. And so I turned the bicycle, and remounted and pedalled steadily down the country road, putting my back firmly to the marshes.
Chapter 8 Spider. I returned some 4 hours and 30-odd miles later in a positive glow of well-being. I had ridden out determinedly across the countryside, seeing the very last traces of golden autumn merging into the beginnings of winter, feeling the rush of pure cold air on my face, banishing every nervous fear and morbid fancy by energetic physical activity. I had found my village inn, and eaten my bread and cheese, and even afterwards made myself free of a farmer's barn to sleep for an hour. Coming back into Crith and Gifford, I felt like a new man, proud, satisfied, and most of all eager and ready to face and to tackle the worst that Mrs. Drablow's house and those sinister surrounding marshes might have in store for me. In short, I was defiant and cheerful. And so I spun around a corner into the square, and almost smack into a large motor car which was negotiating the narrow turn in the oncoming direction. As I swerved, braked, and scrambled somehow off my machine, I saw that the car belonged to my railway travelling companion, the man who'd been buying up farms at yesterday's auction, Mr. Samuel Daly. Now he was bidding his driver slow down, and leaning out of the window to ask me how I did. "I've just had a good spin out into the countryside, and I shall do justice to my dinner tonight," I said cheerfully. Mr. Daly raised his eyebrows. "And your business?" "Mrs. Drablow's estate? Oh, I shall soon have all that in order, though I confess there'll be rather more to do than I'd anticipated." "You've been out to the house?"
"Certainly."
"Ah." For a few seconds we looked at each other, neither one apparently willing to press the subject a little further. Then, preparing to remount my bicycle once I was out of his way, I said, breezily, "To tell the truth, I'm enjoying myself. I'm finding the whole thing rather a challenge." Mr. Daly continued to regard me steadily, until I was forced to shift about and glance away, feeling like nothing so much as a schoolboy caught out in blustering his way through a fabricated tale. "Mr. Kipps," he said, "you are whistling in the dark. Let me give you that dinner you say you've such an appetite for. 7 o'clock. Your landlord will direct you to my house."
Then he motioned to the driver, sat back, and did not give me another glance. Once back at the hotel, I began to make serious arrangements for the next day or so, for, although there had been a grain of truth in Mr. Daly's accusation, I was nonetheless in a firmly determined frame of mind, and more than ready to go ahead with the business at Eel Marsh House. Accordingly, I asked for a hamper of provisions to be got ready, and, in addition, went out myself into the town and bought some additional supplies, packets of tea and coffee and sugar, a couple of loaves of bread, a tin of biscuits, fresh pipe tobacco, matches, and so forth. I also purchased a large torch lantern and a pair of Wellington boots. Far at the back of my mind, I retained a vivid recollection of my walk on the marshes in the fog and rising tide. If that were ever to happen again, though I prayed fervently it would not, I determined to be as well prepared, at least for any physical eventuality, as I could be. When I told the landlord of my plan, that I intended to spend tonight at his inn and then the next two over at Eel Marsh House, he said nothing at all, but I knew full well that he was recalling at the same moment as I was myself how I'd arrived, banging violently on his door in the early hours of that morning, the shock from my experiences etched upon my face. When I asked if I could again borrow the bicycle, he merely nodded. I told him that I wanted to retain my room, and that, depending on how speedily I got through the work on Mrs. Drabble's papers, I should be taking my final leave towards the end of the week. I have often wondered since what the man actually thought of me, and the enterprise I was blithely undertaking, for it was clear he knew as much as anyone not only of the stories and rumours attaching to Eel Marsh House, but of the truth, too. I suspect that he would have preferred me to be gone altogether, but was making it his business neither to voice an opinion, nor to give warning or advice. And my manner that day must have indicated clearly that I would brook no opposition, heed no warning, even from within myself. I was by now almost pig-headedly bent upon following my course. That much Mr. Samuel Daly ascertained within a few moments of my arriving at his house that evening, and he watched me and let me babble, saying nothing himself for the best part of our meal. I had found my way there without difficulty and been duly impressed upon my arrival. He lived in an imposing, rather austere country park, which reminded me of something that a character in the novels of Jane Austen might have inhabited, with a long, tree-lined carriage drive up to a porticoed front, stone lions and urns mounted upon pillars on either side of a short flight of steps, a balustraded walk, overlooking rather dull, formal lawns with close-clipped hedges. The whole effect was grand and rather chilling, and somehow quite out of keeping with Mr. Daly himself. He'd clearly bought the place because he had made enough money to do so, and because it was the biggest house for miles around, but having bought it he did not seem very much at ease within it, and I wondered how many rooms stood empty and unused for much of the time, for apart from a few household staff, only he and his wife lived here, though they had one son, he told me, married, and with a child of his own. Mrs. Daly was a quiet, shy-seeming, powdery-looking little woman, even more ill at ease in her surroundings than he. She said little, smiled nervously, crocheted something elaborate with very fine cotton. Nonetheless, they both made me warmly welcome. The meal was an excellent one of roast pheasant and a huge treacle tart, and I began to feel comfortably at home. Before and during supper and over coffee, which Mrs. Daly poured out for us in the drawing-room, I listened to the story of Samuel Daly's life and rising fortunes. He was not so much boastful as exuberantly gleeful at his own enterprise and good luck. He listed the acres and properties he owned, the number of men in his employ or who were his tenants, told me of his plans for the future, which were, so far as I could ascertain, simply to become the biggest landlord in the county. He talked about his son, and his young grandson, too, for both of whom he was building up this empire. He might be envied and resented, I thought, particularly by those who competed with him for the purchase of land and property, but surely he could not be disliked. He was so simple, so direct, so unashamed of his ambitions. He seemed astute and yet unsubtle, a keen bargainer but thoroughly honest. As the evening went on, I found myself taking to him more and more warmly, and confiding in him too, telling him of my own, albeit small-seeming, ambitions, if Mr. Bentley would give me a chance, and about Stella, and about our prospects for the future. It was not until the timid Mrs. Daly had retired and we were in the study, a decanter of good port and another of whisky on the small table between us, that my reason for being in the area was so much as referred to. Mr. Daly poured me a generous glass of port wine, and as he handed it over said, "You're a fool if you go on with it." I took a sip or two calmly and without replying, though something in the bluntness and abruptness of his speaking had given rise to a spurt of fear deep within me, which I suppressed at once. "If you mean you think I should give up the job I've been sent here to do and turn tail and run..."
"Listen to me, Arthur."
He'd begun to use my Christian name in an avuncular way, while not offering me the use of his.
"I'm not going to fill you up with a lot of women's tales. You'd find those out fast enough if you ask about the place. Maybe you already have."
"No," I said, "only hints, and Mr. Jerome turning a little pale."
"But you went out there to the place."
"I went there, and I had an experience I shouldn't care to go through again, though I confess I can't explain it." And then I told him the full story, of the woman with the wasted face at the funeral and in the old burial ground, and of my walk across the marsh in the fog and the terrible sounds I'd heard there. He sat impassively, a glass at his hand, and listened without interrupting me until I'd reached the end. "It seems to me, Mr. Daly," I said, "that I have seen whatever ghost haunts Eel Marsh and that burial ground, a woman in black with a wasted face, because I have no doubt at all that she was whatever people call a ghost, that she was not a real, living, breathing human being. Well, she did me no harm. She neither spoke nor came near me. I did not like her look, and I liked the power that seemed to emanate from her towards me even less. But I have convinced myself that it is a power that cannot do more than make me feel afraid. If I go there and see her again, I am prepared."
"And the pony and trap?"
I could not answer because, yes, that had been worse, far worse, more terrifying, because it had only been heard, not seen, and because the cry of that child would never, I was sure, leave me for the rest of my life. I shook my head. "I won't run away." I felt strong sitting there at Samuel Daly's fireside, resolute, brave, and stout-hearted, and I also, and he saw it, felt proud of being so. Thus, I thought, would a man go into battle. Thus armed, would he fight with giants.
"You shouldn't go there."
"I'm afraid I'm going."
"You shouldn't go there alone."
"I could find no one to go with me."
"No,"
he said.
"And you would not?"
"Good God, man, Mrs. Drablow lived alone there for, what was it, 60-odd years, to a ripe old age. She must have come to terms with all the ghosts about the place."
"Aye."
He stood up.
"Maybe that's just what she did do. Come, Bunce will take you home."
"No, I'd prefer to walk. I'm getting a taste for fresh air." As it happened, I'd come on the bicycle, but confronted with the grandeur of the Daly home, had hidden it in the ditch beyond the outer gates, feeling that it did not look quite right to bicycle up that carriage drive. As I thanked him for the evening's hospitality and was getting into my coat, he seemed to be mulling something over, and at the last moment he said suddenly,
"You are still set on it?"
"I am."
"Then take a dog."
I laughed. "I haven't got a dog."
"I have."
And he strode in front of me out of the house, down the steps and into the darkness at the side of the house where, presumably, the outbuildings were situated. I waited, amused, rather touched by his concern for me, speculating idly about what use a dog would be against any spectral presence, but not reluctant to take up Mr. Daly's offer. I liked dogs well enough, and it'd be a fellow creature, warm-blooded and breathing in that cold, empty old house. After a few moments there came the pat and scrabble of feet, followed by Mr. Daly's measured tread.
"Take care," he said. "Bring her back when you're done."
Will she come with me?"
"She'll do what I tell her."
I looked down. At my feet stood a sturdy little terrier with a rough brindle coat and bright eyes. She wagged her tail briefly, acknowledging me, but otherwise was still close to Daly's heels. "What's her name?"
"Spider."
The dog's tail flicked again. All right, I said. I'll be glad of her company, I confess. Thank you. I turned and began to walk off down the broad drive. After a few yards, I turned and called, Spider, here! Come, girl, Spider! The dog did not stir, and I felt foolish. Then Samuel Daly chuckled, snapped his fingers, and spoke a word. At once, Spider bounded after me and stuck obediently to my heels. I retrieved the bicycle when I was sure that I could no longer be seen from the house, and the dog ran cheerfully after me down the quiet, moonlit lane towards the town. My spirits rose. In a strange way, I was looking forward to the morrow. Chapter 9. In the Nursery. The fine clear weather still held. There was sunshine and blue sky again when I drew my curtains. I had slept lightly and restlessly, troubled by snatches of peculiar disconnected dreams. Perhaps I'd eaten and drunk too well and richly with Mr. Daly. But my mood was unchanged. I was determined and optimistic, as I dressed and breakfasted, and then began to make preparations for my stay at Ealmarsh House. The little dog Spider had, somewhat to my surprise, slept motionlessly at the foot of my bed. I had taken to her, though I knew little of the way of dogs. She was spirited, lively and alert, and yet completely biddable. The expression in her bright eyes, fringed a little by shaggy hair that formed itself somewhat comically into the shape of beetling eyebrows, seemed to me highly intelligent. I thought I was going to be very glad of her. Just after 9 o'clock, the landlord summoned me to the telephone. It was Mr. Bentley, crisp and curt, for he greatly disliked using the instrument. He had received my letter and agreed that I should stay until I'd at least made some sort of sense of the Drablow papers, and managed to sort out what looked as if it needed to be dealt with from all the out-of-date rubbish. I was to parcel up and dispatch anything I thought important, leave the remainder in the house for the attention of the legatees at some future date, and then return to London. "It's an odd sort of place," I said. "She was an odd sort of woman," and Mr. Bentley clapped the receiver down hard, blistering my ear. By 9:30 I had the bicycle basket and panniers packed and ready, and I set off, Spider bounding behind me. I could not leave it any later or the tide would have risen across the causeway, and it occurred to me, as I bowled over the wide-open marshes, that I was burning my boats, at least in a small way. If I had left anything important behind, I could not return to fetch it for some hours. The sun was high in the sky, the water glittering. Everywhere was light, light and space and brightness, and the very air seemed somehow purified and more exhilarating. Seabirds soared and swooped, silver grey and white. And ahead at the end of the long straight path, Ealmarsh House beckoned to me. For half an hour or so after my arrival, I worked busily at establishing myself there domestically. I found crockery and cutlery in the somewhat gloomy kitchen at the back of the house, washed, dried, and laid it out for my later use, and made over a corner of the larder to my provisions. Then, after searching through drawers and cupboards upstairs, I found clean linen and blankets and set them to air before a fire I'd built in the drawing-room. I made other fires, too, in the little parlour and in the dining-room, and even succeeded, after some trial and error, in getting the great black range alight, so that by evening I hoped to have hot water for a bath. Then I let up the blinds and opened some windows, and established myself at a large desk in one of the bays of the morning-room that had, I thought, the finest view of the sky, the marshes, the estuary. Beside me I set 2 chests of papers. Then, with a pot of tea at my right hand and the dog Spider at my feet, I commenced work. It was pretty tedious going, but I persevered patiently enough, untying and cursorily examining bundle after bundle of worthless old papers, before tossing them into an empty box I'd set beside me for the purpose. There were ancient household accounts and tradesmen's bills and receipts of 30 and 40 years or more before. There were bankers' statements and doctors' prescriptions and estimates from carpenters, glaziers and decorators. There were many letters from persons unknown, and Christmas and anniversary cards, though nothing dating from recent years. There were accounts from department stores in London, and scraps of shopping lists and measurements. Only the letters themselves I reserved for later perusal. Everything else was waste. From time to time, to alleviate the boredom, I looked out of the wide windows at the marshes, unshadowed still and quietly beautiful in the winter sunlight. I made myself a lunch of ham and bread and beer, and then a little after 2 o'clock, I called to Spider and went outside. I felt very calm and cheerful, a little cramped after my morning spent at the desk, a little bored, but in no way nervous. Indeed, all the horrors and apparitions of my first visit to the house and the marshes had quite evaporated, along with the mists that had for that short time engulfed me. The air was crisp and fresh, and I walked all around the perimeter of the land upon which Ealmarsh House stood, occasionally tossing a stick for the dog to chase happily after and retrieve, breathing in the clean air deeply, entirely relaxed. I even ventured as far as the ruin of the burial ground, and Spider dashed in and out, searching for real or imaginary rabbits, digging occasionally in a frantic burst with her front paws and then bounding excitedly away. We saw no one. No shadow fell across the grass. For a while I wandered among the old gravestones, trying to decipher some of the names, but without any success, until I reached the corner where that last time the woman in black had been standing. There, on the headstone against which, I was fairly certain I remembered aright she'd been leaning, I thought I could make out the name of Drablow. The letters were encrusted with a salt deposit blown, I suppose, off the estuary over years of bad winter weather. I remembered that Mr. Jerome had hinted at some Drablow family graves, no longer used, in a place other than the churchyard, and supposed that this was the resting place of ancestors from years back. But it was quite certain that there was nothing and no one except old bones here now, and I felt quite unafraid and tranquil as I stood there, contemplating the scene in the place which had previously struck me as eerie, sinister, evil, but which now I saw was merely somewhat melancholy because it was so tumble-down and unfrequented. It was the sort of spot where, 100 years or more earlier, romantically-minded poets would have lingered and been inspired to compose some cloyingly sad verse. I returned to the house with the dog, for already the air was turning much colder, the sky losing its light as the sun declined. Indoors I made myself some more tea and built up the fires, and before settling down again to those dull, dull papers, browsed at random among the bookshelves in the drawing-room, and chose myself some reading matter for later that evening, a novel by Sir Walter Scott and a volume of John Clare's poetry. These I took upstairs and placed on the locker of the small bedroom I'd chosen to appropriate, mainly because it was at the front of the house, but not so large and cold as the others, and therefore I thought it would probably be cosier. From the window I could see the section of marsh away from the estuary, and if I craned my neck, the line of Nine Lives Causeway. As I worked on into the evening, and it grew dark, so I lit every lamp I could find, drew curtains, and fetched in more coal and wood for the fires from a bunker in an outhouse I'd located outside the scullery door. The pile of waste paper grew in my box, by contrast with a few packets I thought ought to be examined more closely, and I fetched other boxes and drawers full from about the house. At this rate I should be through by the end of another day and a half at the most. I had a glass of sherry and a rather limited but not unpleasant supper, which I shared with Spider, and then, being tired of work, took a final turn outside before locking up. All was quiet. There was not the slightest breeze. I could scarcely even hear the creeping of the water. Every bird had long since hidden for the night. The marshes were black and silent, stretching away from me for miles. I have recounted the events, or rather the non-events, of that day at Ealmarsh House, in as much detail as I remember, in order to remind myself that I was in a calm and quite unexcitable state of mind, and that the odd events which had so frightened and unnerved me were all but forgotten. If I thought of them at all, it was mentally, as it were, to shrug my shoulders. Nothing else had happened, no harm had befallen me. The tenor of the day and the evening had been even, uninteresting, ordinary. Spider was an excellent companion, and I was glad of the sound of her gentle breathing, her occasional scratching or clattering about in that big, empty old house. But my main sensation was one of tedium and a certain lethargy, combined with a desire to finish the job and be back in London with my dear Stella. I remembered that I meant to tell her that we should get a small dog, as like Spider as possible, once we'd got a house of our own. Indeed, I decided to ask Mr. Samuel Daly that if there were ever a chance of Spider having a litter of puppies, he should reserve one for me. I had worked assiduously and with concentration, and taken some fresh air and exercise. For half an hour or so after retiring to bed, I read The Heart of Midlothian. The dog settled on a rug at the foot of my bed. I think I must have fallen asleep only a few moments after putting the lamp out, and slept quite deeply too, for when I awoke, or was awakened, very suddenly, I felt somewhat stunned, uncertain for a second or two where I was and why. I saw that it was quite dark, but once my eyes were fully focused, I saw the moonlight coming in through the window, for I'd left the rather heavy, thick-looking curtains undrawn, and the window slightly ajar. The moon fell upon the embroidered counterpane, and on the dark wood of wardrobe and chest and mirror, with a cold but rather beautiful light, and I thought that I would get out of bed and look at the marshes and the estuary from the window. At first all seemed very quiet, very still, and I wondered why I'd woken. Then, with a missed heartbeat, I realized that Spider was up and standing at the door. Every hair of her body was on end, her ears were pricked, her tail erect, the whole of her tense as if ready to spring, and she was emitting a soft, low growl from deep in her throat. I sat up, paralyzed, frozen in the bed, conscious only of the dog and of the prickling of my own skin, and of what suddenly seemed a different kind of silence, ominous and dreadful. And then, from somewhere within the depths of the house, but somewhere not very far from the room in which I was, I heard a noise. It was a faint noise, and, strain my ears as I might, I could not make out exactly what it was. It was a sound like a regular, yet intermittent bump or rumble. Nothing else happened. There were no footsteps, no creaking floorboards. The air was absolutely still. The wind did not moan through the casement. Only the muffled noise went on, and the dog continued to stand, bristling at the door, now putting her nose to the gap at the bottom and snuffling along, now taking a pace backwards, head cocked, and like me, listening, listening. And every so often she growled again. In the end, I suppose because nothing else happened, and because I did have the dog to take with me, I managed to get out of bed, though I was shaken and my heart beat uncomfortably fast within me. But it took some time for me to find sufficient reserves of courage to enable me to open the bedroom door and stand out in the dark corridor. The moment I did so, Spider shot ahead, and I heard her padding about, sniffing intently at every closed door, still growling and grumbling down in her throat. After a while, I heard the odd sound again. It seemed to be coming from along the passage to my left at the far end, but it was still quite impossible to identify. Very cautiously, listening, hardly breathing, I ventured a few steps in that direction. Spider went ahead of me. The passage led only to three other bedrooms on either side, and one by one, regaining my nerve as I went, I opened them and looked inside each one. Nothing. Only heavy old furniture and empty unmade beds, and in the rooms at the back of the house, moonlight. Down below me on the ground floor of the house, silence. A seething, blanketing, almost tangible silence, and a musty darkness, thick as felt. And then I reached the door at the very end of the passage. Spider was there before me, and her body, as she sniffed beneath it, went rigid. Her growling grew louder. I put my hand on her collar, stroked the rough, short hair, as much for my own reassurance as for hers. I could feel the tension in her limbs and body, and it answered to my own. This was the door without a keyhole, which I'd been unable to open on my first visit to Eel Marsh House. But I had no idea what was beyond it, except the sound. It was coming from within that room, not very loud, but just to hand on the other side of that single wooden partition. It was the sound of something bumping gently on the floor, in a rhythmic sort of way, a familiar sort of sound, and yet one I still could not exactly place. A sound that seemed to belong to my past, to waken old, half-forgotten memories and associations deep within me, a sound that in any other place would not have made me afraid, but would, I thought, have been curiously comforting, friendly. But at my feet the dog Spider began to whine, a thin, pitiful, frightened moan, and to back away from the door a little and press against my legs. My throat felt constricted and dry, and I began to shiver. There was something in that room, and I could not get to it, nor would I dare to if I were able. I told myself that it was a rat or a trapped bird fallen down the chimney into the hearth and unable to get out again. But the sound was not that of some small, panic-stricken creature. Bump, bump. Pause. Bump, bump. Pause. Bump, bump. Bump, bump. Bump, bump. I think that I might have stood there.